Hello, hello, everybody. Stephen Molyneux from Free Domain. Got some fine questions from the readers on X, which I will answer now. Have you ever looked into how spanking as a behavior evolved? Do other primates spank their offspring? Do children who aren't spanked have higher rates of not understanding that actions have consequences? Well, I hear what you're saying, right? I get what you're saying. Is it natural? Natural is like this Aristotelian mean. You don't want to go totally animal, right? Because that's not human, right? We are the higher animals. We can prepare proposed actions to ideal standards, develop universal concepts, reason, morality, empathy, and so on. So at the same time, we don't want to design or have a society that goes against all of the natural grain of humanity and how we evolved. So for instance, communists don't like profit. However, human beings have only survived and evolved because of a profit. In other words, we have to figure out whether hunting is going to take 1,000 calories to give us 500 calories. That would be a deficit, and enough deficit in terms of calories or water means death, right? And so all organisms are finely tuned to figure out profit and loss. If you just look at a lion hunting a zebra, right? If the zebra is too far away, then the lion is either going to pull something or trip or not catch it or catch a hoof to the face or something. And so the lion gives up, right? If it can't, so then it has a sort of calculation. So all living organisms are kind of finely calibrated to pursue profit versus loss, or at least even Steven. So if all animals cuff or hit or brutalize their offspring, maybe that's natural and so on. But the thing is, you want to train your children for adulthood. Adulthood. Actions have consequences. Okay, let me ask you this. If you are late in providing a report to your boss, does your boss get to pull your pants down, put you across his knee, and whack, whack, whack you repeatedly? No, that would be assault. That would be illegal. We want to raise our children to live in the world of adulthood. And in the world of adulthood, you don't get hit for failing to do things at work, even in your health. If your doctor says, you need to take these pills, right? I mean, I remember my doctor, when I was a kid, I had a sore throat. He gave me some antibiotics. And then I had a sore throat some 6 months later. And I went back and he said, I'm going to need to give you some more antibiotics. And I said, well, I could just finish the ones that I had because I took them till my throat got better. And then I stopped taking them. So I still have some leftovers. And he got really angry. And he's like, I mean, it was a German doctor, what can I tell you? A little psycho. But he was like, you know, you got to take them all. Otherwise, you're just training bacteria to become resistant. And I was really angry. Okay, whatever. I mean, kind of a stupid thing to do. On his part, he could have just been more clear. But, you know, when doctors are unclear, it's always your fault. But what he didn't do was pull me across his knee and whack me or swat me. He didn't hit me at all because that would be assault. So even if you don't follow the instructions of your doctor, which is obviously more important than following the instructions of your boss if it's around health, but if you show up late for work, you don't get spanked. If you miss a shift, you don't get spanked. So what are you doing by creating consequences that are violent and illegal for adults in the adult world and think that you're teaching your children to do anything useful at all? It's like teaching them a language. They'll never, hey, you know what, kid? I'm going to teach a Klingon and Elvish because that's going to come in really helpful when it comes to getting the ladies. So spanking actions have consequences? First of all, that's kind of built into human beings to know that actions have consequences. But you want to mirror with your kids the kind of negative feedback as your kids grow that they're going to get out there in the world. So if they do things that are annoying or repetitive or whatever, then you simply say, I find that annoying and repetitive. And if they keep doing it, you just disengage and dissociate, right? If you have a son and he keeps playing too rough, right? With you, if you're his dad or whatever, he keeps elbowing you in the face or cracking you with the knee across the nose or something like that, then you tell him to be careful. If he's not careful, you just stop playing with him, because that's what happens in the real world. If you give people repetitive negative stimuli, they just want to stop doing things with you. That's the real world. That's how the world acts as a whole. And so you can train your children in negative consequences, but what you want to do is train your children in negative consequences that mirror what happens in the real world so that the lessons match the outcomes. So spanking is not part of adult negative consequences. So why on earth are you inflicting something that is going to be in no way, shape, or form part of their actual adult life? It doesn't really make any sense. So yeah, just because animals do it, you and me, baby, we are nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. It's actually a pretty funny song. But we're not animals, so we don't want to act in contravention to animals, but we also don't want to do exactly what animals do, right? So goldfish will eat until their stomachs rupture, like Americans, and that doesn't, but so we have to eat because animals eat and we're animals, but we don't want to eat to the point where our stomachs rupture. So the other thing too is that society clawed its way out of infinite falsehood, right? The cause and effect in almost all of human society's evolution was totally wrong. The rain hasn't come because we haven't sacrificed a goat to the rain gods, right? I mean, we lost the battle because we didn't sacrifice a newborn on the eve of battle, or we didn't pray hard enough or whatever, right? I mean, my wife fell out of love with me because someone cast a spell on her. Well, actually, it's kind of feminism, so maybe that's a little bit more accurate. But, you know, feminism is just witchy 2.0. So the cause and effect in almost all of history was incorrect. Aristotle went half mad trying to figure out why are there tides. They couldn't figure out that the moon would do it. Because a moon that big, having that much effect, I mean, the moon would be called Kardashian. It would be a totally different situation. So we arose, we tunneled our way up out of completely wild, mystical, superstitious, endless error. Oh, we got to pray for a good tide, a good current. It's like the praying won't do anything. But so we were helpless, so we prayed. But because we were prayed, we'd remained helpless. So if you pray to a rain god, and then there's these priests who run the rain god cult or whatever, you pray to the rain god, then you have to give stuff to the priests, and then they will plead your case to their rain god and get the rain. If the rain comes, obviously it worked. If the rain didn't come, you did something wrong. It's your fault, and you got to do something different. So the problem is, if you start bypassing the rain god priesthood and you start saying, you know, I think we've just got to start building irrigation. We've got to, you know, start to figure out how to get the water to the crops. We've got to plant different crops. We've got to plant closer to the water source. Then this is considered an act of blasphemy against the rain god, and they'll try and get you killed. Because if you start taking control of your own water delivery mechanisms to the crops, then you don't need the rain god priesthood. And then they would have to get real jobs rather than just being liars, actors, and con men for the most part, I mean, almost exclusively. So the problem is helplessness leads to superstitious pretend cause and effect. You pray to the rain gods. But then once that solution is there, society tends to stagnate horribly, because the moment you start to deliver your own water, you bypass the rain god people, they'll call you an unbeliever, a blasphemer, a heretic, and they'll get you killed or driven off. So the helplessness leads to superstitious cause and effect. Reliance on superstitious causes and effect creates a class of people who profit from that and don't want to get real jobs. And then they'll kill you or ostracize you if you start to do something that is effective and actually helpful. So because we emerged or tunneled our way out of endless, fantastical, mystical, superstitious bullshit, then how do you get children to believe things that aren't true? How do you get anyone to believe things that aren't true? Well, the things that aren't true are almost always measured. Their untruthfulness, their lying nature, their falsehood is directly proportional to the amount of aggression, threats, and violence it takes to put them into place, right? So if you want your children to believe in things that are counter-rational, counter-factual, counter-empirical, counter-evidence, then you have to use aggression. You can't get people to believe things that are false without threatening them for their common sense. I mean, that's just the basic. And most of human society evolved out of predatory era, right? It's predatory era. The king is put there by God. The priesthood is there to save your soul. They're going to infect you with an illness called original sin, and then you will pay forever and ever, amen, for a cure, right? Because in order to save you, they have to damn you first. And so you are going to be indoctrinated with cultish, false, predatory, exploitive lies of a political and theological and ideological kind. And if you don't believe those lies, you will be threatened. Your soul will be threatened, your life will be threatened, your genes will be threatened through ostracism or banishment or prison or straight up being killed. And so truth is always met with violence, and lies always rely upon violence. And so, of course, we evolved with endless exploitive predatory era, and because we evolved out of lies, violence against children was needed in order to sustain those lies, right? And we can say it's good or bad. Obviously, it's false, and to me, I don't care where society goes as long as I tell the truth. I have zero concern for outcomes in society. I just need to tell the truth because I simply can't stand for mankind to have another 1,000 years of utter bullshit, violence, lies, predatory exploitation, and hundreds of millions or billions of bodies. I can't do it. Tell the truth, though the skies fall. Tell the truth and shame the devil. Thou shalt not bear false witness. That's all I'm about. So if you remove violence from the raising of your children, you know what? Do you know what you have to do? It's a pretty wild thing. If you take violence off the table, you have to reason with your children. And children are factual, empirical, and rational. If you have to reason with your children and you can't use violence, the world has a slim chance of somewhat sanity. Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. The world has a slim little chance of actual truth, actual reason. Now, of course, there's advertising and so on, and people are like, you know, if you wear these cool glasses, you'll look exactly like this model who's wearing these glasses. I mean, that's not a threat, right? That's a little bit of a vanity bribe or whatever it is. But, you know, the one thing that's beautiful about the free market, I mean, obviously the free market is a property rights, self-ownership, voluntary trade, is that the free market or the absence of violence, by definition, both people end up better off. So, you know, I went to buy glasses. Every 2 years, I need a slight adjustment in my prescription. So I went to buy glasses, and the place that sold the glasses wanted my money more than it wanted the glasses. And I wanted the glasses more than I wanted my money. This is why the trade occurred, because they are better off with money, not glasses, and I'm better off with glasses, not money. So I paid, $200 or whatever it was for my glasses, and they're $200 happier, and I'm one set of glasses happier. It's win-win. Reason is win-win. When I'm in a debate with someone, if we're both following reason, we both win. It's like if one country has a cure for AIDS and one country has a cure for cancer and another country has a cure for heart disease and they all trade, everyone's better off. So violence is win-lose. Reason is win-win. And the only stable society is founded on win-win. All societies that are founded on win-lose collapse. So you can measure a society's rationality by its levels of aggression against children. All right. Let's see here. Let me get to this next one. It seems obvious that Charlie Kirk's murder will not be pinned on the Israel lobby. Are these people walking into a trap? What are the consequences of this downstream? I mean, it seems like Tyler Robinson, the trial is going on at the moment. I'm not following it closely, but it seems like Tyler Robinson is pretty much the guilty party, absent some completely unforeseen circumstance. I have to say alleged, because not proven in a court of law. But, you know, he confessed, his parents turned him in, his, you know, he's got video of him shooting and packing up the gun. I mean, so the cause and effect is pretty simple. To get people attacked in society is pretty easy, sadly. I mean, it is pretty easy. So what you do to get someone attacked, how you get those lasers on their forehead? Well, you say, this is an evil guy whose words are causing immense harm, hurt, pain, and destruction to others. That's really, so you will create a group, let's call them the Elbonians, right? It's a sort of made up country from Scott Adams, who I still miss. But you create this group of people in society, you call them the Elbonians. And then you say the Elbonians are children. They're like children. They're taken advantage of. They're manipulated, bullied. They're just striving for a better life. They just want nothing but the best. You know, they're just trying and striving and hoping and praying, and they just want to contribute and all of this, right? And then you create, and this is womanly stuff, right? Women see the child inside the criminal. Men see the child harmed by the criminal. Women see the child in the criminal, which is why women tend to thwart punishment in that sense, right? So what you do is you say, well, these Elbonians are just, they're wonderful, striving people. They just want nothing but the best. And then you put them in TV shows and you put them in movies and they're all just wonderful, amazing, fantastic, excellent, beautiful, noble, blah, blah, suffering people. So you elevate the Elbonians to like angel status. And then you say that anyone who criticizes the Elbonians is a vicious, hate-spewing, bigoted, whatever. Right? And then you have all in all the media, you know, the Elbonians are walking serenely with their angel wings trailing behind them, trying to heal the sick and trying to do all these wonderful things and just hold it together in the face of this crazy hatred that comes out of nowhere and is just evil. And so, yeah, so you say that you elevate. It's just, I mean, the world runs on fiction, not facts, at least for now. Or it always has. We hope to change that over time. So you elevate the Elbonians to both wonderful, amazing people, and then there are just these anti-Elbonian hateful people, you know, like you just wake up and hate them and hatred, they spew, always the word spew, right? They're spewing hatred and they're just, and just incoherent. And the Elbonians are all portrayed as noble and sort of helpless. And so the hatred of the anti-Elbonians is just this toxic, corrosive force that is just causing the Elbonians to drop like flies, and they're rousing up hatred. And so then what you do is you say there are these noble Elbonians, there are these hateful people who just randomly, mysteriously hate Elbonians, and the hatred of the anti-Elbonians is causing the Elbonians to die. And then it just becomes self-defense. It programs people to view any anti-Elbonian sentiment as irrational hatred that will get people killed. And then you can either do, you just do self-defense on the part of the Elbonians. It's really a sad, but kind of inevitable process that goes on. And this process has been going on for, I mean, geez. Pretty much all of human history, right? So those who ask questions, those who point out inconvenient facts are just, they're full of hatred. It's my hate speech, right? It's called hate speech, right? Which is not an argument, of course, right? Speech you hate is not hate speech. You could hate it because, so, and if the Elbonians are actually exploiting society but playing the victim, then you get the closed loop. Because the Elbonians don't want people to point out their own exploitation of society as a whole, and therefore anyone who criticizes the Elbonians want those person taken out of the public square, taken out of society as a whole. So I don't know about the Israel lobby. I don't really know anything about it. Some people say he was killed by the Israel lobby. I don't believe that. But anyway, if you could write a letter to 10-year-old Stefan, what would you tell him? If you could write a letter to 10-year-old... That's a tough call, man. That's a butterfly effect question. Because I am so immensely proud of what I've done with my life that I'm not sure I'd want to do anything going back in time that would alter my trajectory. I mean, obviously I've made mistakes, blah, 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 for sure. But so, I mean, let me sort of give you an example, right? So I met my wife in my early 30s and we met and dated and became boyfriend, girlfriend, got engaged and got married and started trying to have kids in 11 months. Now, if I had said to my younger self, don't worry, the love of your life will come along in your early 30s. What would that have changed? I had to be in the right place in my life. I'm very glad I met my wife. My wife practiced psychology for like 27 years. She was a mental health professional and expert and worked in hospitals and private practice and was massively influential in pointing my philosophical mind at the family rather than just at abstractions and politics and ethics. But it all starts with the family, was what she said, and she was completely right. And so I had to be in the right place. I had to have already gone through therapy. What triggered me going into therapy was the breakup of a long-term relationship with a woman I was engaged to. Should I not have had that relationship? If I didn't have that relationship, would I have gone into therapy? If I hadn't gone into therapy, I wouldn't have succeeded in wooing and winning my wife, who's very knowledgeable and very robust when it comes to self-knowledge and mental health. I don't know, man. If I were to go back to my 10-year-old self and say, don't worry, it's all going to work out well, would I have put less effort into things? I mean, do you save much money if a message comes back from your 60-year-old self saying, don't worry, when you are 50, you'll win the lottery? Okay, so let's say you did win the lottery at 50. If you had sent that message back saying, it's all going to work out well, which it has, if you sort of go back and say, hey man, don't worry, it's all going to work out well. You're going to be happily married. You're going to have a very, like the most meaningful career that you can conceive of. But don't talk about IQ too much. I mean, that needed to be talked about. Sorry, you cannot fight communism and totalitarianism. You cannot fight totalitarianism and political power without talking about IQ. You just can't. Because IQ explains why some people do better and some people do worse to a large degree. Not obviously 100%. I'm not a determinist. But like not everyone who's tall has to be a basketball player, but almost all basketball players are pretty tall. So when I look back and I say, well, you know, when I talked about the voluntary family back in 2006, man, we got, I mean, we, the Freedom and community, myself, of course, we just got savaged. But now people talk about it, like going no contact, and it's good for your mental health if you have really toxic parents. Can you get the later progress? Can you move the Overton window without, can you move the window without bad cuts from the glass? Oh, I don't know. I don't think you can. I don't think you can. Society, when someone comes along with ideas that are consistent but shocking, rational but upsetting, society doesn't judge the ideas. It judges the commitment or the tenacity of the person who has the ideas, who, and I have never, never will I have never retracted anything I know to be true. And I have been under not inconsiderable pressure to retract things that I know to be true, and I just won't. I would rather withdraw from all public life than retract things that I know to be true. That would be an act of foundational cowardice. And, I mean, I know my history. Sigmund Freud realized that in the upper society in Vienna, where he practiced in the 19th century, child sexual abuse was rampant. And he betrayed those children. And that set humanity back catastrophically. And I've made the case that Sigmund Freud betraying the children who said that they were assaulted in the most horrendous ways by adults around them, mothers and fathers in particular. And he said, no. Well, he said this, and then he was threatened, and then he retracted it and said, you know what? I bet you they just really want it. You know, the Oedipus complex, the Electra complex. They're just fantasizing about these kinds of horrifying interactions with mother and father. It's not real. They're just fantasizing about it. One of the most foundational betrayals in human history. I won't. There is no force on earth that would compel me to. I don't say everything that is true, because I'm for maximum philosophy, and in the Overton window, I don't mind getting some cuts, but I don't want to get beheaded. But I will not retract anything that I know to be true. That's not the deal. I've been given an immense gift in my mind. That sounds like in my fantasies. My mind is just an amazing place to be. And the gift and joy and pleasure of what I'm able to conceive of, reason out, and communicate is such an amazing gift that the idea that I would use it for my own advancement or my own selfish pleasures or, you know, mere money-making or control or power, influence or politics, it would be horrendous to me. You know, billions of years of evolution have given you and I these brains. My brain is quite remarkable. I say this with humility. I didn't earn it. It just is the way. I didn't earn it any more than I earned having blue eyes. It just is what it is. And it is really, really important when you have gifts that you did not earn, that you recognize that they are a collective benefit not to be used for your own selfish pleasure. Like, I say this with regards to if you're just some incredibly physically attractive woman, that is there for you to have a big, wonderful family with a high-quality man. Good for you, and good for you, right? You didn't earn it, though, for the most part. I mean, you didn't earn the base genetics. Of course, you exercise and all of that to probably keep yourself slender and healthy, but when women take their significant physical attractiveness and turn it towards, I'm going to go travel, I'm going to go to Dubai, I'm going to get some purses from a sugar daddy. Like, they are taking this immense gift that's evolved over billions of years that is there for the collective good of mankind, and they have turned it towards their own selfish consumption pleasures, which is horrendous. It's just horrendous. So, I have achieved what I have achieved on the, and again, this is why I always thank everyone here in the community for giving me these great questions, and also for, support, freedomain.com/donate. Summers are kind of rough for income, so if you could help out, man, I would really, really appreciate it. Again, I also understand people are hurting, so if you can't afford to continue to enjoy the shows, don't feel bad about it at all. I really sympathize with that. I've been broke a lot in my life. But I have achieved what I wanted and continue to expand what I want, which is a pretty good situation to be in. So I'm not sure that I would go back and say anything to my 10-year-old self. If you shoot an arrow over a house and land right in the bullseye, would you go back and say, aim differently? I don't think so. So I sort of hate, I mean, of course, you can't go back in time anyway, but I wouldn't tell anyone, oh, it's everything's going to work out. Because one of the main reasons why everything works out is because you don't think it will, or you don't know that it will. If you're in high risk for heart disease, you should obviously maintain a healthy weight and exercise and get checkups and all that kind of stuff. And if somebody said to you, oh, don't worry, your heart's going to be fine, you'd stop doing that and then your heart wouldn't be fine. So not much would I change. All right. In countries where homeschooling is illegal, what's the best thing we can do for our kids? I'm keeping them in school as little as possible and to do a minimum amount of homework, no pressure to succeed. It's tough. It's a tough situation. Move. Move to a place where you can homeschool. You can get a new community because, I mean, really, it's just torment. It's torment for kids. What are you going to do? You're going to tell them, well, the teacher is just a cucked, spineless, paid propagandist who doesn't really care about children, only cares about three things, ideology, time off, and her pension. So what are you going to do? The teachers are not worthy of respect, but you should go there anyway. Everything they're teaching you is lies, and they're incompetent people and not very intelligent, which is the case in general for teachers, particularly in government schools. And they will throw as many children into the brain blender as humanly possible as long as they get to suck up some of that fiat currency juice from the remnants. So there is no good answer. There is no good answer in the situation of compulsion, right? If you were forcibly married to someone you hated and you were forced to stay married, people say, well, what should I do? I say, well, get away. And if you've got to go to the other end of the planet in order to get away, do that. What do you think the West looks like in 25 years? That one I'm not going to answer because it really is dependent upon everyone's choice. It really is dependent on everyone's choice. If you have corrupt people in your life, and you're willing to break bread with them and continue to spend time with them, then the West will be a terrible place. If you yourself are willing to take a stand for that which is right and true and good, and try to reform the corrupt, inform the corrupt, and if they refuse to drop their corruption, drop them in the same way that you would drop a piece of rotting fruit you were about to eat, then the West goes well. If people don't do that, which I can't control, I can just say you should do it and it's the right thing to do. Whether you actually do it and whether other people do it is up to them. So, what is your theory of consciousness? Do you think the brain is a receiver or it, for it or of it? Or does it originate in the brain? Yeah, well, of course consciousness originates in the brain. Come on. Come on. You know, if I said to you, I'm at the gym, and a heavy weight is going up and down, would you think it would be going up and down on its own or ghosts would be lifting it? No, you would say, well, somebody must be lifting the weight up and down. Of course you would, right? If I were to say to you, I hear the joyful sounds of a saxophone floating, is it raining in New York down Fifth Avenue? If I hear the lovely strains of a saxophone drifting across the night air, would you think that the saxophone was playing itself or a ghost was blowing into the saxophone? No, you would say there's an effect called the saxophone noise, and assuming it was a live saxophone, not a recording, blah, 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 right? Then you would assume that somebody was blowing the saxophone. Well, somebody had to be blowing the saxophone at some point, even if it's a recording. So the effect is proximate to the cause. You can't get the sound out of a saxophone without a saxophone. And weights don't lift themselves. Somebody has to be moving them in one way or another. And so, you know, if I lift my hat, right, then my hat is lifted by me and it's put down by me. Well, I guess I could let gravity put it down, but I put it down snug, evenly. So, of course, consciousness is an effect of the brain because we never see consciousness without a brain originating it, right? So this is not I don't even find this room. I mean, I guess it's controversial if you believe in the soul or things like that, but Ghost in the Machine is not an answer to anything real. So yeah, of course it's an effect of the brain. What is more important, being truly loved by a woman or having a lot of money? I mean, I pause not because it's a difficult thing, but if you're truly loved by a woman, your odds of making a lot of money go up considerably, right? So if you're truly loved by a woman, she wants to bear your children, she wants to run your household, she wants to support you in your career, she wants to do all of these wonderful things, then your status is very high. If you're truly loved by a woman, she'll work to stay attractive, which means you're high status because of that. And the fact that you are loved means that you're confident. I mean, being loved is a superpower, because if you are truly loved, then those who hate you are irrelevant, if that makes sense. If you're truly loved, like let's say you are the Beatles in their prime, right? Let's say you're the Beatles, the band, the Beatles, in their prime, like 67 or whatever it was, right? And then you come across, you know, you're Paul McCartney, and you come across someone who says, the Beatles suck, right? It's like, but everywhere you go, millions of screaming fans, your records are flying off the shelves, you're called, I mean, Sgt. Pepper's is a brilliant album and so on, and you're innovative and creative, you're a multi-zillionaire, you're at the top of your game. I mean, I know that, so if you're truly loved, it's a superpower that's kind of incomprehensible to other people. I mean, the people who love me in my life matter infinitely more than people who fetch, bitch, and moan at me online. I mean, why would that matter, right? It's funny in a way. There is Monty Python. John Cleese, I think, was talking about, somebody was saying, oh, the parrot sketch is derivative and repetitive or whatever it is. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, but it's been very famous for decades, and it was voted like the funniest sketch, and people still reference it, and I see it. So, you know, if you have enough evidence in one direction, then the few counterpoints in the other direction don't really mean anything. I know that I'm a good person. I know that I tell the truth, and I know that I try to benefit humanity as much as possible in all the ways that I can. I also know that the degree to which I can affect humanity is directly proportional to the willpower of you. I mean, I can come up with the ideas, the arguments, and make the case. You're the one who has to spread it. And you're the one who has to live it, right? I can write a diet book. You're the one who has to put down the fork with four cheesecakes on it, right? So I'm loved by good people. I love good people. I examine my conscience like every day. Don't you? Am I doing the right thing? Is there a better thing I could do with my time? Is this the right approach? Is the most valuable and useful thing that I could do? Could I try something else? I examine my conscience and my purpose. I mean, I'm not like the Dalai Lama who shapes his intention for like an hour every morning, but I think every day about what I can do to bring maximum philosophy in the short, medium, and long term. Sometimes if I'm a little burnt out on philosophy, I'll take a little bit of time and I'll exercise or go for a walk or do something else. And that's partly to recharge so I can do it more over the long run. I take time off from philosophy to exercise, of course. And I do that because I want to be able to do philosophy into my dotage, right? Or my old age. Hopefully it won't be a dotage. So it's a false dichotomy to say being loved by a woman versus having a lot of money. If I had to choose, of course love. Of course love. Love is not a hedonic treadmill. The hedonic treadmill, of course, is you buy something that you want and you're very happy about it for a day, a week, or whatever it is, right? And then you settle back to normal. Love just keeps getting better. Love just keeps getting more enjoyable. So you can't buy love, and we are social animals, not material animals. We're not acquisitive animals. In other words, our most sustained happiness comes from our relationships, not from the stuff that we have. And, you know, of course, you know this. Everything that you have will lose meaning, will lose form, lose substance, lose shape, right? Everything. Everything you have is destined to be dumped, burnt, buried, recycled. You know, let's say a little closet back here. It's a nice little closet. I don't really think about it that much, but it's a nice little closet. I mean, it's going the way of the dodo, right? Maybe this will last 50 years. Maybe it'll last 100 years. It'll end up in somebody's house. It might end up in my daughter's basement, or maybe she'll give it to a friend of hers or whatever it is. So it'll end up someplace. It won't be my closet. It'll just be some closet out there with stuff in it. And then eventually it'll just sort of wear out or wear down or whatever it is. And then people will just, they'll put it on the sidewalk or take me, and maybe someone will take it and some student. And then, but eventually, you know, whatever, 50, 100 years or whatever, it's just going to fall apart. It's going to go to nothing. It's going to go to nothing. It's true of everything that you have. Everything you have is subject to the law of entropy and is devoid of meaning. So I write about this in my novel, Almost. It's a great book. You should absolutely read it. But, you know, your very first computer, you know, had a lot of meaning to you. My very first computer was a 8K Atari 800. It was an Atari 800 because it was 8K. It had a real keyboard. The Atari 400 had 4K and a membrane keyboard. But that meant a lot to me. Now, if I still had it, I sold it many years ago, but if I still had it, it would be, oh, that was my very first computer. But if it's in some garage sale, somebody buys it, it's just some old computer. It doesn't have everything that you imbue things with that have meaning to you, right? Oh, yes, this was the first dollar I earned and I had it framed. Okay, fine. It's just a dollar to someone else. Not your first dollar or something like that. Or, you know, in my basement, I've got two little carvings. I've got some little carvings that my wife and I got on vacation. I mean, they're kind of ugly, but you know, if I'm down there, sort of, I remember that vacation. But they're just going to be ugly carvings to people who weren't there, and they'll just be thrown out. They'll just be thrown out. Just be thrown out. Now, some people, you know, achieve prominence and so on, and then their stuff has more meaning to other people. I get all of that, but that's like one in 10 million people, right? So all the stuff that you have has meaning to you, but the meaning dies with you. The meaning dies with you. You know, if you have a lock of hair from your first girlfriend or something like that, I mean, it means something for you, I guess. But for someone else, it's just going to be some kind of icky strands of protein and just going to throw it out. Everything that you have, it's going to be fought over by strangers. It's going to be junked and grossed out and thrown out. And your first car is now a cube somewhere in landfill, and none of it matters. But with love, you can build relationships, you can build children, you can do amazing things that will outlast you. But the stuff itself doesn't matter. None of it matters. So the stuff that you accumulate dies with you. The love that you used to generate outlives you. Love is the closest thing we get to immortality. Love of wisdom. That's what philosophy means. Fundamentally, it's love of wisdom. All right, how did you become famous? Your name has always sounded familiar, but all I know is that your takes are very good. Could Google it, but I wonder how you see it. Apologies if dumb question. No, there's no dumb questions. There are only bad typos. So here's a little tip, my friend. Are you ready? Little tip. I'm going to get nice and close up here, but I won't yell, I promise. Little tip. Please don't say Google it. So if somebody says to you, I get all of my information from a pathological lying con man, well, you probably wouldn't take anybody's information very seriously at that point, now would you, right? Of course not. So, yeah. don't Google things. Don't Grok AI, I think, is pretty good. Maybe there are others out there that you like. But yeah, don't Google things, man. I'm not just talking about me, of course. You know, Wikipedia is used to sort of launder horrible false statements to people, and then it goes through Google, and that keeps people away from philosophy. So how did I become famous? I became famous for great passion, solid reasoning, good evidence, and reckless courage. I say reckless, like, oh, I'm just so courageous. Sounds like I'm too sexy for my heart. But no, I rushed in where angels fear to tread, and people were just like, I can't look away. I don't want to watch what's going to happen to this guy. And then, of course, I hit the despawning. I got canceled from like everywhere and so on, right? So how did I become famous? Just telling uncomfortable truths way ahead of my time. That's all. All right. What does your diet look like? And do you take any supplements? All right. What does my diet look like? Well, my wife is a fantastic cook, and she's very, very keen on cooking from ingredients. She doesn't use tinned stuff or canned stuff. She just buys stuff raw and whips up these amazing meals and so on. I am an eater. I exercise, blah, blah, blah. I've maintained a healthy weight. In fact, I weigh less now than I did when I was 20. So I weigh about 188. I'm just a shade under 6 foot tall. And my diet, I don't know. I mean, so I don't eat much in the morning. I will usually not eat much in the morning, if anything. I just generally try to wait till I'm hungry, which is usually around maybe two or 3 o'clock. I'll eat something. I'll have a fairly big meal. Evenings, I eat. Like, I'll have a meal, and then I'll have a bowl of yogurt and berries and a little granola, a little bit of honey, and then maybe I'll have a piece of cheese before bed. But I like to eat. I like to eat, and it's always been a bit of a shock to me that I haven't gained as much weight because, yeah, I like to eat. Supplements, what do I take? I take lutein. Optometrist recommended for eyes, coenzymes for heart. I take some supplements that are supposed to help with hearing and tinnitus. I have a little bit of tinnitus in my left ear. Oh, anything else? I mean, I take a little creatine. People say the creatine is really good. I've not really noticed any difference. Yeah, I mean, I get pretty good food as a whole, so I don't really find the supplements do much. I just, you know, take a few for reasons of prevention of things getting worse, and that's about it. I try to get some sunlight, and I try to get 10,000 steps and all of that. So, yeah, my diet, it's kind of carby. I do love bread, although I've switched to sourdough bread over the last couple of years, which I find is a little easier as a whole. Like pastas, and I like meat for sure. And my wife, though she's a vegetarian, is very good. She's very good with the meat. All right. When will the pain of inaction exceed the pain of action? What's it going to take? Hyperinflation, child brothels? I don't know. I mean, most people distract themselves from the state of the world and just kind of hope that things will not get worse much, or maybe we'll get a little better. And I can kind of understand that. I mean, if I woke up every day, you know, looking at how much money has been printed by central banking and knowing the disaster, I mean, I wouldn't really have much happiness. So most people can't do anything about politics. Once something moves into the realm of politics, right? Once it moves into the realm of politics, it is outside of the control. People are always like, well, how did men let it get to this state, and how did the West let this? Nobody let anything. I mean, the governments print and bribe and borrow and take. And what do you do when they control things, right? I mean, if your government is sending a bunch of foreign aid to some country, I mean, Is it worth really getting that upset about? You can't do anything about it. I mean, you can't. I mean, just let's be honest about it. If I thought that we could do things about politics, I wouldn't be a voluntarist. I wouldn't be an anarcho-capitalist. Once things pass into the realm of state coercion, they are beyond your power. Once, was it Jimmy Carter, the Department of Education at the federal level? So once you've got the Department of Education setting the curriculum for a lot of schools, most schools maybe, in some areas for sure, and like what can you do? I mean, you can go and you can thump the table and you can try, and you know, maybe a few people can budge the needle a little bit, but that's only if they've got kind of OCD and don't know statistics and are willing to devote years and years of their life and so on. And the government will always be happy to help you, like if you help it expand its powers. But most people, I mean, we know this from the Milgram experiments, right? Most people will just do what they're told. They'll do what they're told and they'll call it good. And they'll just go with the flow, and they're like the ballast of the species, right? They're needed for historical productivity, but they don't change much in the world. Whether that's right or wrong, good or bad, it is what it is. So, Steph, you have a different tone talking to women versus men. There's a bit of infantilization compared to men. Even I, as a woman, I have to start my sentences with, "Hi, girl, you're so beautiful. Do you know where I can find?" Or else I don't get a response. What the hell is that? So, I mean, people say this to me. I don't know. I mean, they don't give me particular examples, so I don't know if it's true or not. But, of course, I'm going to speak different to different types of people. I try to suss out people's personality. It's something that Mick Jagger said, you know, it depends whether you're playing a stadium or a club. Like, it's a whole different scenario and so on. So with women, it's not that I say, oh, this is a woman, I need to talk in a different manner. It is, I will probe what they respond to in conversation, and I will tend to focus on that which they respond to the best. So, of course, you've heard me say it a million times in call-in shows, how long have you been listening to what I do? I don't like to say a show because it sounds like a jazz hands, but how long have you been listening to what I do? And if somebody says, oh, I just heard about you on the Sam Hyde show, I haven't listened to any shows, then I have a particular approach. If somebody says, I've been listening to you for 10 years or 15 years, I have a different approach. With women, in general, you have to make them laugh in order for them to really listen. Or you have to really show your benevolence in order to get them to listen. This is not a criticism at all. I'm just telling you the way that it is. I've been a professional communicator pretty much my whole life, and certainly for the last 20 plus years in the public square. And I've had thousands and thousands and thousands of these conversations. That's just in the last 20 years. I've had many, many more before. So if a woman is convinced that you have great affection towards her, and her situation and sympathy, she will really listen. With men, it tends to be a little different. With men, they tend to respond to strictness, and women respond to affection. Broad categorizations and so on. So is it true that I will have a different tone with women than with men? Yeah, well, I can certainly see that for sure. Also, women tend to be more earthy when it comes to a bit more sort of raunchy statements or raunchy comedy and so on. And women are much less delicate that way. Men tend to be a little bit more romantic. Women, because they squat and give birth to actual human beings and bleed every month, tend to be a little bit more earthy in the physical. So there's some differences there as well. So, is boys chasing, hitting, or trying to catch animals like dogs and pigeons normal developmental behavior, or does it usually signal abuse or muddled violence at home? No, I don't think it's bad. Boys are hunters, right? They evolved to be hunters. So, why do people react so strongly, even violently, when you simply tell them not to hit defenseless children? Because most people are 5 to 10 seconds away from self-hatred. There's a very foundational principle you need to understand in this world if you're going to talk virtue, right, wrong, morality with people at all. Most people are 5 to 10 seconds away from self-hatred. And they're like on a tightrope. They're only just sort of dimly aware of it and so on. So, you know, under COVID, if you bring up, like, Sam Neill died, an actor, recently, and he was very pro lockdowns. He was very pro vaccines and very the COVID quote vaccine and all of that. So most people, if you point out how they behaved during COVID, and that they turned on their fellow citizens who were asking completely rational and sensible questions about what the hell was going on, with all of this. Like, I opposed lockdowns. I never took that therapeutic goop. So if you point out this, then they go, you know, if they really get it, they'll say, oh my God, I would have just gone along with whatever the government told me. I would have been the bad guy in every government lockdown, and I'm kind of a soulless automaton, and they'll hate themselves. So if people have hit their children a lot, I mean, you know, once or twice you apologize, you know, we all make mistakes, but if you've hit your children a lot, and if you, somebody really gets you to understand how brutal and violent that is, then they'll hate themselves, and you can't go back and fix it. So this is why people double down, because it would be like injuring them so that they had a bad back for the rest of their life. I mean, they would view that as a grievous assault, as it would be. And having a bad back is still a whole lot better than having a bad conscience that you're aware of, right? Also, people are lazy, which is why they go with the flow. And if you point out that they've done something wrong, then they're kind of morally obligated to turn around and try and fix it, right? So if you hit your kids, then you got to go apologize to your kids. You got to change. You got to go to therapy. You've got to talk to other people about not hitting their kids. And people don't want to do that because it's hard work. And it can be unpleasant work, of course, right? So yeah, people are 5 to 10 seconds away with the right sentences. People are 5 to 10 seconds away from hating themselves forever or being put on a path of redemption that would be absolutely brutal for them. So, all right. How do we cope with people who are unable to reason in a free society? Yes, I answered that question last time. What should I do, says someone, if I'm demonized by the state and for much of society for my entire life for a mistake I made when I was 17 when I had an inappropriate relationship, this person says, though consensual and no touching, with a 14-year-old. I've completed all programs and paid every fine. Well, I'm sorry about the situation as a whole, of course. The best thing to do is to really get to the root of how this all came about, how this exploitation came about. And if you figure out the root causes of how it came about, and call.freedomain.com, I would be eager to talk about this, call.freedomain.com, just set up a call with me. If you figure out the root causes of how it came about, then you can start to help people see these root causes and prevent other people from getting into these kinds of terrible situations. Why does forgiveness with families never work? Because if it's forgiveness within families usually is when the adult child has grown up and is confronting parents about bad behavior. The reason why forgiveness doesn't work is because when you say to someone, you did me wrong, and then they apologize, you're supposed to forgive them. But there's no point really apologizing if restitution is impossible. All right, so restitution is, oh, I broke your lawnmower, let me go and get it fixed. Okay, here's your lawnmower back, like it was never broken, sorry for the inconvenience, blah, 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 then you fixed it. But if you're a parent and you were aggressive, abusive, neglectful, avoidant, or abandoned your children, you can't fix it later. You can't go back and fix it later. I mean, if you didn't get enough food as a kid and you grew up to be a foot taller, what's your parent going to do, give you extra food now? Let's say they starved you as a kid. What, are they going to give you extra food when you're 30? What's that going to do? It's not going to go back and make you taller. You can't fix childhoods after they're over. And because restitution is impossible, forgiveness is meaningless. Happiness is fleeting. Should it be pursued? Well, happiness is fleeting if it's based on hedonism, if it's based on pleasure. Happiness based on virtue is not fleeting at all. Happiness based on virtue, love, integrity, consistency, truth-telling, and moral courage, I tell you, man, that is not fleeting. I mean, it can be a bit of a roller coaster at times, but it is not fleeting. Why are the lyrics of songs from most female singers degenerate or self-sabotaging these days? Chapel Roan, Sabrina Carpenter, Marina, etc. I knew a woman named Marina many years ago, and people called her Worf from Star Trek. Anyway, for obvious reasons. Well, everyone who's allowed to become famous serves the powers that be, obviously, right? If your book is published and promoted, it's because it is introducing some additional toxic mold syllables to the collective lungs and brain of mankind. So it's not that, oh, you know, all of these women happen to become famous and happen to have, you know, horrible lyrics about how terrible men are. And like, you can't be famous. You're not allowed to be famous if you promote health. If you promote truth, you're not allowed. I mean, huge demographic changes in England. Imagine that somebody wrote a song with as beautiful a lyric as Yesterday, but it was mourning demographic changes, and it was talking about these horrible assaults against 250,000 little white British girls. I mean, would that person, I mean, I guess you could release it online and so on. Let's say it went to number one and so on. I mean, what would happen to that person? Think of all the artists in England. Think about Paul McCartney and people like that. I mean, they've seen the huge change. They're never going to write a song about it. Never. I mean, Eric Clapton wrote one song, I think, about vaccine skepticism and, I mean, became... So you're only allowed to be prominent if you're toxic, for the most part. I mean, there's exceptions, somewhat. But even that is becoming less and less common. Like, you were allowed to be right-wing in the 90s, 80s and 90s, if you were an action star. But even that's becoming more and more rare. So it's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence. All right. Hi, Steph. I am a previous donor of yours, and despite my name here, I'm dead serious. My father had a great life, was expecting another grandson, and said to be the happiest in years, yet he hanged himself a week ago. No health or economic problems, happily married. Why did he do it? Obviously, I can't tell you that. I don't know him, and I called up freedomman.com. We can talk about it. But I think when people have a profoundly positive external presentation, then oftentimes that hides a holiness from within. A lot of people say, I want people to envy me because I don't admire myself. And you can see this, of course, all over social media, Instagram, and other places. I want people to lust after me. I want people to admire me. I want people to think I have the greatest life. I want people to think I'm super cool. I want people to like my abs. I want people to admire me or to envy me because I don't respect and admire myself. And the only thing we can really respect and admire about ourselves is virtue, integrity, honesty, and all of that kind of good stuff. So if your father was presenting as having this great, wonderful, perfect, amazing life, so happily married, professional success, I got money, I got my health, then the question is, a lack of vulnerability hollows people from the inside out. And for more on this, I did a show called The Truth About Robin Williams many years ago. Was math invented or discovered? Well, neither. So invented is when you create something completely new. Discovered is when you come across a treasure chest that was buried 100 years ago, sort of Count of Monte Cristo style. So it was math was not invented in that it's not an arbitrary thing that is just coming out of nowhere. It is not discovered because it is not something that pre-existed. Math is the correlation of concepts to instances in the world, right? So I have one coaster, right? It's a coaster to put my coffee on. I have one coaster, right? I have two objects, one coaster, one pair of glasses, right? So one and two, these aren't arbitrary. They're not discovered. They're not invented because one and two doesn't exist. If it go the other way, it's two and one, right? So numbers are the correlation between concepts in the mind and instances, which means discrete segregated things, instances in the world. We have eight planets because there are eight balls of whatever, right? And so math is neither invented nor discovered. Math is a generated set of concepts that must accurately describe instances in the world, aggregations of instances in the world. Are you following Christianity? I don't know what that means. Does that mean, am I a practicing Christian? I am not. What's the best way to restore the grout in my shower? It's very funny. What's the best way to restore the grout in my shower? Well, I assume don't use it for a long time and then rub groin, ass, and armpits into the cracks. Do you know who is Thomas Sazz? S-A-Z-S-Z. I would be curious to know what you think of this psychiatrist who, in my opinion, brought a bit of philosophy into the world of psychiatry and psychology, who, without being bad in itself, I appreciate Carl Jung, became a barrier to the free. I'm not quite sure what that means. But I thought, did I interview him? I know I interviewed a whole bunch of people, even Norm Finkelstein way back. Did I interview Thomas Sazz? I'd have to check. Maybe yes, maybe no. But yeah, I've read his book, and he is very good. I really can't express the horror at the state of psychiatry and medicine these days. I mean, the whole antidepressant thing, right? There is no chemical brain imbalance. It's all just a lie. It's been disproven countless times. Dancing has a much better outcome than SSRIs. SSRIs are virtually indistinguishable from placebos. And even the, you know, they say, oh, but for the most depressed, even for the most depressed, it's barely better than placebo. Exercise, dancing, cognitive behavioral therapy, talk therapy, and so on. Walking is as good or better than SSRIs. It is horrendous. It is horrendous. How much people are willing to lie for money and how much people are desperate to pop a pill rather than change their lives? It's an unholy union. Yeah, and it's hard to say which side is better than the worst. Is it a pull economy or a push economy? Well, you need both for the transaction to take place. So I don't think that modern psychiatry can be criticized quite enough. Food is science. Would like to see you on Timcast. Maybe a debate with a D&D campaign with Tim and Ian. Yeah, I'm not. I mean, it's nice. I'm not going to go on Timcast, I'm sure of that. Hey, Steph, I listened to a podcast. Evil Jeff Bezos. May I ask who created the system that is pushing companies to apply DEI? What are their benefits? Why did they build the system? So white Christian males are the natural enemies of collectivism and communism, totalitarianism, and so on. And so whatever diminishes the strength, power, authority, incomes, and prestige of white males is good for those who want to expand political power. So DEI is not about giving jobs to non-white males. It's about keeping jobs away from white males so that family formation can't occur. Why do you assume everyone is based? I don't know what that means at all. I'm not sure I would have gotten into so much trouble, all the trouble that I did do, if people were actually based. So I think I'm pretty much aware of that. All right. Thank you for the great questions, my friends. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Call me this summer. It's quiet in the summer, so there's room. call.freedomain.com, shop.freedomain.com for your merch, and peaceful parenting. If you could share that link, I'd appreciate that too. Take care, my friends. Bye.